The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the show. We've got a terrific show for you here today on Capital Thinking. We're going to spend the first half hour talking to one of the freshman leaders in Congress, a little bit about what's going on at the intersection between business and government. Joining us today is freshman Congressman James Lankford, Republican from Oklahoma, and also joining us is my colleague Brian Lopina from Patton Boggs. Congressman Lankford, for those of you who aren't familiar with him, was elected to Congress last November, part of the freshman wave that helped Republicans take back the House of Representatives. Before being elected, he was the director of one of the nation's largest youth camps with about 51,000 guests every summer. Now, Congressman Lankford spends his time serving on a number of committees in the House of Representatives. Perhaps most importantly, he's one of the few freshmen who actually holds a gavel in his hands as subcommittee chairman for the House Subcommittee on Technology, Information Policy, Intergovernmental Relations, and Procurement Reform. I cannot say that three times fast. So, Chairman Lankford, first of all, welcome to Capital Thinking, and let me start by asking you to tell us a little bit about the mission of your committee and the subject matter jurisdiction that you all have and how that relates to the business community.
You bet. Thanks, Kevin. Glad to be able to be with you on it in this conversation today. The committee itself is a committee that deals with a couple areas. One of them, deals with unfunded mandates. That is what the federal government puts down in requirements and through legislation and regulation onto private businesses, local governments, state governments, counties, cities, and such. The second aspect that comes in really large for us is the technology side of what we do in the federal government. Are we really communicating? Are we doing this the right way? And then the third piece deals with this procurement. As every business that deals with the federal government knows, there are serious problems in how we do procurements, both in grants and in our contracting. And we're starting to take little bites off of that and say, okay, what can we do to help businesses be able to navigate this bureaucracy that has become the procurement process?
Yeah, it sure seems like government sets out to figure out how the business community works efficiently and then endeavors to create the exact opposite in many cases. So I know we want to sort of dive into that a little bit more. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Congressman, you're one of a handful of freshman members who I think in history has had the chance to hold a gavel in your hands and to be called Mr. Chairman. So first, my congratulations on that. But tell us a little bit about how you move so quickly up the ladder and the skills that you bring to bear on this subcommittee.
Well, I don't know if I'm quickly moving up the ladder, but we are trying to accomplish what we feel like we're there to accomplish, and that is to be able to help us work through this regulatory process that has become just a nightmare in what's happening in federal regulations. The thing that I have done and have been communicating with my own committee and with the leadership has been we have got to be serious about working for actual solutions. We talk about it a lot, but a lot of our hearings are nothing but talk. At the end of the day, we had a hearing. We didn't accomplish anything but embarrass someone that came before it, but we have no end product. So we're actually doing hearings based on what are the issues, what are the costs, what are the things that we can make a difference on, thinking that through, trying to get with people that it actually affects to create legislation that will propose solutions to it and not just talk about it. So that's been the key for me, is finding answers. I did not come to Congress just to be on the lectern. I've never been in politics before. I've been in private business, and I want to be able to get focused on how do we solve this.
terrific. I love it. Plain spoken and goals oriented. That's terrific. That's what we need more of.
Well, that's how most people do their normal life. They don't try to get into the newspaper the next day. They try to actually solve the problem the next day. So that's what we want to stay focused on this committee as well.
Well, I got to imagine that, as you said, you're a first-time elected official, and so you really have a deep connection with folks and understand what created this wave election in the last 2 years. And you must have a very finely tuned ear for what people's complaints are about the regulatory process. So tell us a little bit about what you might have heard on the campaign trail or what you hear now when you go home about the frustration the business community has with the regulatory process.
Yeah, I've yet to run into anyone in the business community that's talked to me and said, okay, I need you to do this special favor for me and try to carve something out. What I hear from the business community over and over again is there any way we can make this stop? At least let us catch up. There are so many regulations coming out so quickly, so many things that were listed as guidelines by the federal government that are actually being used as a rule rather than a guideline. There are so many areas that they're talking about making changes, and as the federal government talks about making a change, it shuts down investment in that category. And so we are slowing down investment in America and just basic capital production moving forward with anything. We're slowing all that down because of a million rumors and a million guidelines that are coming out from the federal government saying, here's what we want to do, here's what we want to do. And at some point, we've got to have some kind of regulatory scheme that actually makes sense for business.
Very good. Well, let me turn things over to my colleague, Brian Lopina, who has a great deal of experience in some of the areas you're an expert in. Brian, I know you've got some things you want to talk to the congressman about as well.
Absolutely. And thank you, Kevin, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for joining us. I wanted to dig in a little bit here on the unfunded mandates issue. And just to educate our listeners here for a bit, you know, anytime the government comes up with a great new idea for a new regulation, oftentimes with a very noble purpose behind it, it is another hoop somebody's got to jump through. It's another requirement that a business or a small government, whatever it may be, has to do. And, of course, it's unfunded in that it's a directive, you must do this, and, of course, we're not going to give you the funding to do it. So
that's right.
Why it's called an unfunded mandate. Now, Congress passed a law back in 1995, which sounded pretty good at the time. It's the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act, one of those great Washington acronyms, UMRA. And it basically said, look, you know, anytime there's a new regulation that's going to be proposed, let's get those affected, be it business, local government, whoever's affected, let's bring them in, let's consult with them, let's see what they think about it, and then let's weigh the costs and the benefits. And indeed, if you know, it looks like it's going to be too much of a burden, then maybe we can modify the regulation or maybe even get rid of it altogether. So a great idea and concept, but as the hearings that you have had, Mr. Chairman, have borne out, in the history of this law, there really has actually been a relatively small percentage of regulations that have even gone through the UMRA review, let alone be modified because of it. So now that you've gotten yourself some great feedback from the Obama administration, also former Bush administration officials, private sector, local government, why do you think it is that so few of these regulations are undergoing the review?
Yeah, I'd say there, it was with everything in government, there are a million reasons that are laid on top of that. Ultimately, the law itself was so watered down by the time it was passed in the 1990s that it left a lot of loopholes in it. For instance, all the independent agencies were excluded. So SEC would be completely excluded. This new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that's now rising up out of the Dodd-Frank piece, it will be completely excluded. So any regulations they write, regardless of their unfunded mandates, do not apply under this unfunded mandate reform act. So that's a large exception on that. There are exceptions based on things. For instance, if you get a grant in for Medicaid, the federal government will say, well, we can do any unfunded mandate we want to do with that because that money is voluntary. Your state could choose to not take that money for Medicaid, or it could choose to not take that money for transportation or education. So they'll say it's not truly a mandate because you could choose to opt out of it. But in reality, what they're saying is to a state, this is the money that came out of your state. To be able to get it back, you have to fulfill our requirements. If you don't want the money back to your state, then you can just opt out entirely. That's just ridiculous. So they created so many exceptions in it that it really is not very effective and has very little teeth.
Mm, yes. Another issue that came up in the hearings is that for those regulations that actually are under the UMRRA review. The review is evidently not capturing the true full cost of the mandate. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, it doesn't. It catches their hopeful cost on it. It's an estimate that comes up that is done during the legislative period that is scored to say this is what we think it will be, but there's no way to really be able to go back and evaluate what was the actual cost of that and make sure it's in line. And once it is a piece of legislation, the regulatory group just takes off on it. There is no real control on it at that point. So there are a lot of things that we've got to do. To me, some of the primary focus is there has to be some kind of stability in our regulatory scheme. If we don't have some sort of consistency that business knows there won't be another regulation on this particular industry for X number of years, and it will come at this season, so there's some predictability to it, we're going to have a problem. And if all these independent agencies are constantly excluded and they can do every regulation that they want to do, no matter the cost, then that's nonsensical as well. So there's no reason the independents should be included in the same kind of restrictions as what would be on the other side of that, the dependents on it.
Well, let me jump in here. Chairman Langford, we're going to go to commercial in just a minute, but folks, we're going to be back with a whole nother segment with Chairman James Langford, Republican from Oklahoma, the subcommittee chairman on the House Subcommittee on Technology, Information Policy, Intergovernmental Relations, and Procurement Reform. Keep it here for more Capital Thinking. We'll be right back.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We're continue to be joined by Chairman James Langford, Republican from Oklahoma, who is a key subcommittee chairman for the House Subcommittee on Technology, Information Policy, Intergovernmental Relations, and Procurement Reform, having a great conversation about how regulation isn't doing enough to help business get where they want to go in creating jobs and improving our economy. Joining me for this segment and the last is Brian Lopina, a colleague of mine here at Patton Boggs, who has a great deal of expertise in this area. And Brian, I want to get back to you and your questions. You were on a roll talking a little bit about the fascinating world of UMRA review, so let me throw it back to you.
Well, thanks very much, Kevin. We were just talking about the requirement that cost-benefit analysis under the review, and we were discussing the full cost of really not being captured by the existing law. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you, Mr. Chairman, is the way that the law defines cost is really limited to direct costs for that particular business to comply, but the true cost is bigger. That's the effect on the economy where, okay, you're going to have to have some cost for the company, but that may result in raising the price of your product or having to lay off someone because you only have so much revenue to come in. There's a whole ripple effect that comes through some mandate that comes down on high from the federal government, and appreciate your thoughts on that.
Oh, that's very accurate on it. Of course, there's no way to really be able to count the indirect costs on it. That's simply a guess as it works through. But they do look at the direct cost. But everyone knows the direct cost is going to be much smaller than what the indirect effect of that will be. Let me give you an example on our state. EPA is currently coming down on one of our power generating companies at a natural gas-fired power plant based on the cooling intake. They built this power plant. There's a huge lake that is around it that they constructed. And then basically the water is used as the radiator running through this power plant to keep it at a consistent temperature. Well, the water as it comes in has a screen that keeps fish and debris from being able to come into that radiator, and a few fish, and I mean minnows, small tiny fish, die on this little screen as it breathes the water in on it. The EPA is now coming in and is going to require them to do millions of dollars of changes on this screening because of the death of a few minnows on this thing. And it is an irrational change on it. Now, they can do a lot of things on it, but I can tell you from being out fishing before, every time I go fish, a minnow dies. And so if EPA is now taking on its authority to say, I'm going to keep minnows from dying in a pond, we're going to be in trouble, and we're going to be passing on a lot of additional mandates. But that increase in cost to that power generating company is going to be passed on to every rate payer. Mm-hmm. So everyone in our state is going to pay a higher rate based on an EPA mandate that's been passed on to them that they could do nothing about.
Mm-hmm. Brian, I'm going to start a business that makes signs that says no minnows were harmed in the production of this energy.
Sounds like a warning label to me.
Well, I did have to ask the EPA directly if this is some new mandate that they're taking on based on some newfound powers that they have. I've asked them directly in a hearing if they are also planning on creating a limitation for the new wind generation farms, because these large new windmills that are generating wind power do kill birds as they fly through the air, and you'll see at several of the windmills a pile of birds at the bottom of them that are dead, that the bird just didn't see that blade coming around and smacked them. So I'm asking the question, are we to expect from EPA some new regulation for how to screen off these windmills to keep birds from flying into it?
Oh, boy. Well, that's a horrible horror story, unfortunately. And thanks for, staying on that one. Let's talk a little bit more about UMRA and its implementation. You've had the current, now, first of all, for our listeners here, the action on this is with the Office of Management and Budget within the executive branch, and in particular, there's something called the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, in other words, these great acronyms, OIRA. That is the one-stop shopping central location for regulatory review. And you've had, Mr. Chairman, the current head of OIRA, testify, the Obama administration person, and also the Bush administration person. Obviously, two entirely different perspectives when it comes to a view of the economy and the role of government. But what is your view on how well the Obama administration is implementing UMRA, both from the standpoint of interpreting what cost-benefit means and also the consultation with the private sector?
Right. What's interesting is the executive branch has had a stronger version of UMRA through the executive branch, what's called Executive Order 12866. Well, we're going to get in the weeds of all these different acronyms and everything. But Executive Order 12866 has existed since the Clinton administration, and it basically tells Office of Management and Budget, and then through OIRA and all these groups to be able to go in and examine what they do and what they're requiring through regulations. That sounds like a great idea, but the practical usage of that is where it boils down, and there's a problem. There is an impression that those in Washington may understand that there's a cost to it, but they see it as being a benefit long-term to the economy, or a benefit long-term to the environment, or a benefit long-term to consumers, and so they'll just add on the cost. When agency after agency says, yes, I understand there's a cost, they pass on the information back to OMB saying there's a cost to this, but we think it's warranted and that's checked off, it becomes very difficult to be able to justify that. And it ultimately has a very small group of people from D.C. saying we're going to make decisions on how this affects the rest of the economy from here. And that's the part that makes me nervous. And quite frankly, Cass Sunstein, for the president's head of OIRA, is a very sharp, very intelligent man. But we have a very different perspective on how government should function. Mm-hmm. He uses the term technocrats and says that he is in favor of a small group of very educated technocrats looking at the cost-benefit for what happens in the economy rather than allowing the populace to be able to determine what works best in our economy. I just don't share that same opinion.
Well, it's interesting. That very powerful office, OIRA, is, in addition to its UMRA responsibilities, this is an initiative that was kicked off at the initiative of the Obama administration, a very comprehensive review of all federal regulations with the goal of streamlining them when possible. Now, they have produced 30 different reports from agencies, quite detailed. It's an interim report, sort of a draft report, no final conclusions, but looking into your crystal ball, Mr. Chairman, do you think at the end of the day that this exercise is actually going to result in some real changes that will make life easier for businesses, or maybe just some nibbling around the edges?
I think initially it would be nibbling around the edges. Let me make a couple comments about it. There's been much ado to say this is the first time this has ever happened, this is a comprehensive review, we're doing yada, yada, yada. This type of review has been done in some form since the Carter administration by every president. That is common to be able to look at the regulatory environment. Obviously, through the 60s and 70s, a lot of these regulatory agencies started coming of age. Every president since then has done a review of regulations. Now, the interesting thing is when I have some of these regulators in my committee and we'll ask them about specific regulations, they always respond the same way. Well, those regulations were given to us by the authority of Congress. We have to do those legislation. They're fulfilling our regulations are fulfilling legislation. So I'll be very interested in the final report of the things that they looked at and said, actually, these regulations don't fulfill any legislation, and we're getting rid of them. That part's going to be, I think, to me, the most educational, is what aspects of it these agencies consider really don't fulfill legislation, but they have been protecting for years and years and years and saying that they do. So we'll see in the days to come how this comes out. Currently, I think it's going to be nibbling around the edges. I have high hopes always that we're going to get a chance to move forward and make some real differences.
Congressman, let me jump back in here. I know your subcommittee is one that has just a wide range of jurisdictions. So talk to me a little bit about some of the other topics that you're hoping to have your committee delve into, especially since you take the approach that hearings aren't just for show, but you want to get some substantial accomplishments out of them.
That's correct. We just started a series of hearings on grants. Grants are one of those areas that there is very wide latitude within each agency of how they give out a grant. There's not a consistent set of regulations. There are some circulars that are put out from the Office of Management and Budget, but no consistent set of guidelines for if I'm going to send out money out the door for some public purpose, how was that awarded? The people that didn't have the award given to them, why? What was the reason given? Then the accountability through it. Was the money actually spent for what it was requested for, and was the final product actually what we'd requested for? We don't know on most grants, and we have literally billions of dollars going out of the door of many of these agencies that we have no idea the end result of how it was used. That's not wise. I'm not saying it's full of fraud, but I'm saying we don't know what it is.
Can I interrupt you on the grants? I've heard a lot in the business community's frustration with the way stimulus grants in particular went out. There seems to be, if you were to overlay that map with the president's electoral ambitions, there seems to be a strong correlation between who gets grants and who doesn't.
Well, and that's part of our concern is to say we don't know. They don't have to come back and inform us on why they gave a certain grant, what the criteria was, how this group was selected. Was this somebody they went to college with? Was this a political favor back? Or was this actually something that was very warranted? My suspicion is many of them were very warranted, but there's going to be a portion of them that we're going to find out at the end of it. We can't figure out what the criteria was or how that was based. That can't be that way in government. We've got to have better criteria than that.
Well, I certainly salute that you wanted to look in that. Congressman, I've got about 2 minutes left, and we've talked a lot of business. I want to talk a little bit about you so people get to know you a little bit better. Share with us a little bit in your first, you're wrapping up your first 6 months in Congress, the surprises and disappointments of the beginning of your first term.
I can tell you, most people, I think, have a perception of Congress that's a whole group of these hardcore politicians that they can't relate to. I think most Americans, if they walked onto the House floor and walked around, they would meet a lot of people they like and people that actually think like them. The House, the 435 members of the House, are as diverse as America. And your representative may not think exactly like you, depending on who your representative is. But if you walked around the House floor, you would find someone that thinks just like you. And so I think most Americans would be very pleasantly surprised to be able to see that. For me, the hard part for me personally has been how much talk there has been and how little work there has been to find solutions. A lot of what happens in D.C. is press releases and hearings and things that actually don't accomplish anything. And there are very few times that I actually see people working towards an end to solve a problem. And I think it's because so many years, so many people have been burnt. As soon as you propose a solution, take Paul Ryan, for example. We've got major problems with Medicare. It is going insolvent, and everyone knows it. So he proposes a solution. Everyone attacks him for proposing a solution, trying to push him back in the corner and say, don't propose ideas, just talk about the problems like us. Well, I think that time's got to be over. We've got to have a whole new group of people that actually talk about solving it rather than just talking about it.
Very good. Well, Congressman, that's going to do it for us. I encourage our listeners to get out and visit the chairman's website, learn more about what he's doing to reform procurement and make sure that our federal tax dollars are spent in the most effective manner possible. Chairman, we thank you for joining us. We look forward to perhaps having you back in the future. We'll be back after this commercial with more Capital Thinking.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live
from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, it's been a while since we talked about the energy sector, so we're going to do that here today. Joining us is Steve Goldenberg, who's a partner with the law firm of Fox Rothschild and is resident in one of their New Jersey offices. Steve actually is the chair of the firm's Energy and Public Utilities Practice Group and spends a great deal of time, obviously, practicing in that area. Steve is the founder of the New Jersey Large Energy Users Coalition, comprised of major manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies and other large commercial customers there, and also serves as that group's counsel before the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities and the New Jersey Legislature in connection with all energy-related matters. So first, Steve, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I am well, Kevin. Thanks for inviting me.
Good. Well, listen, I know New Jersey's like a lot of other states. They are trying to ramp up their power for a variety of purposes, primarily to be a great magnet for business, be it manufacturing, commercial, whatnot. But I know you and your group are having some issues with a variety of regulatory agencies. We've just spent a half hour with a Republican congressman who's trying to untie some of the knots of the regulatory agencies. Now we're going to get into it on a nuts and bolts basis from your perspective as a practitioner. Tell us a little bit about New Jersey's plan and how various federal and state agencies may be sort of kinking up that plan.
Well, I wanted to discuss today the New Jersey plan to build some power plants. Basically, the problem began in 1999 with the restructuring of New Jersey's electric and natural gas industries. Before the restructuring, our Board of Public Utilities could order utilities to build power plants when they were needed. However, with the restructuring and the breakup of the utility monopolies, the BPU essentially gave up jurisdiction over generation, which then became an unregulated service. So the BPU essentially lost the ability to direct generation to be built. And since 1999, little generation of any consequence has been built in New Jersey. Instead, the state has been plagued with retirements of power plants that have not been replaced. We currently import 25% of our power from out of state. Transmission lines have been approved by the PJM Regional Grid and FERC that take power from New Jersey into the more lucrative New York market. New Jersey has also been frustrated by an inability to develop backbone transmission lines like the Susquehanna-Roseland line. And also of great consequence, the Oyster Creek nuclear plant will be retiring soon. So clearly there's a major issue confronting New Jersey and something has to give. We have an aging generation fleet that's comprised of 30 to 50-year-old plants. They're expensive, inefficient, and emit a lot of greenhouse gases. We're now paying for clunkers that should be retired to remain in operation simply to assure the reliability of the power grid. And of great consequence, there is a growing concern, and PJM agrees, that the state could soon face brownouts. In fact, since 2005, PJM has been on record saying that New Jersey needs 4,000 megawatts of generation yesterday and about $700 million in transmission upgrades.
Very good. Well, let me jump in there and talk a little bit about what's being done by the state of New Jersey and by PJM, perhaps separately, to address this issue. I guess what always frustrates me is everybody agrees we need more power, and then we have NIMBY problems, but we also just have bureaucratic malaise that seems to stretch what should be a couple-year project into decades to get things done when we know we need them done.
We have all of those problems. To help remedy the problem, PJM years ago adopted what they call the reliability pricing model, which is complicated. I won't get into the weeds on it, but it basically uses an auction pricing model that's designed to incent the development of power plants where they're most needed. The thought was to increase the cost of capacity in those areas to incent developers to build them. Unfortunately, this hasn't happened. But RPM is costing New Jersey ratepayers well over $1 billion a year. And as I think you can imagine, my large energy users are not happy about that. Clearly, incumbent generators aren't building, and other generators have been frustrated by PJM policies that deter new entry, including the absence of a long-term price signal to encourage investment. And they also have an interconnection process that is expensive and cumbersome. So in response to that, New Jersey adopted its own program. It's called the Long-Term Capacity Agreement Pilot Program, or LCAP, and it was enacted into law this year. Through LCAP, the state authorized potential ratepayer subsidies of new plants in certain circumstances. This was to satisfy the finance community and to solve the financing problem that has plagued power plant development for a decade. Under the LCAP program, three plants have been approved for a total of 2,000 megawatts of capacity.
I see. Well, there must be, since this is a new law, there must be some issues relating to the state's LCAP law that you're grappling with as they try and actually implement it.
Absolutely. A number of generators have combined together with PJM to oppose the LCAP legislation, and fights are occurring as we speak both in FERC and in federal court. The generators argue that new generation isn't needed for reliability purposes, and they are technically correct, at least on a snapshot basis, but I don't think this would be true as a long-term proposition. They argue that LCAP will upset the functioning of the capacity markets, that it will artificially depress the price of capacity, and that it will create a situation where all future generation will have to be subsidized by ratepayers to get anything built.
Very good. Well, I know FERC has to be a big player in this, so tell me a little bit about FERC's reaction.
Well, they are, and they've sided with PJM and the generators, and they've established minimum prices for capacity that basically negate the value of the subsidy created by the LCAP law. FERC has expressed concerns about the ability of buyer market power by the state that could artificially depress market prices in the PJM markets. Therefore, FERC modified what they call their minimum price rule, which could prevent LCAP capacity from being accepted by PJM, thereby creating what could be an insurmountable impediment to the program.
Very good. Well, I know my wife's from New Jersey, grew up there, and there is one political figure that she loves right now, and that is Governor Chris Christie. So I hear a lot about Chris Christie's reform plans for things like education and budget issues. I don't know much about what his plans are on the energy front. So educate us a little bit about what the Christie energy plan looks like and how this issue sort of fits in it.
Well, there is clearly a showdown between the Christie administration, FERC, and PJM, and it is clear that New Jersey is not going to back down. The administration is threatening litigation and to take matters into its own hands, including the potential withdrawal of the state from PJM. This is not likely, but it's one of the options that's available to the state. More likely, the state is looking to find other ways for the state to provide incentives to developers, either through streamlined approvals, tax abatements, financing incentives, and things of that sort. But it's also resurrected a thought that goes back about 4 years, whether New Jersey should establish a power authority to spur power plant development. And as it's being discussed, the authority would have an investigative and planning function. It would offer financial, permitting, tax, and other incentives. And it could arrange buyer aggregation deals or offer long-term power purchase agreements. This is developing into a real states' rights issue. Hearings are ongoing at the BPU now, and the BPU is actually now considering whether the state needs more than 2,000 megawatts of new plants. The Christie administration is prepared to challenge FERC's rulings in the D.C. Circuit Court. I guess to sum up in response to your question, the state is clearly determined to move forward on the plants, and it won't back down. You've seen Governor Christie when he gets wound up. Draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be on the other end of that argument when he gets all wound up. Tell me some of the consequences. I guess two questions. One is New Jersey representative of the problem states are having with new power generation? Are they special? And two, what are the consequences of some of this development not getting done for our economic future?
Well, I think New Jersey's problem is shared by several states in the Northeast. Maryland comes to mind first. Connecticut has also had issues over the past years about capacity. It's not a general problem felt throughout the country, but there are circumstances perhaps unique to New Jersey that make this a potentially very important issue here.
Very good. And then the consequences if we don't follow through on some of this stuff?
The problem, as I said, is there's a very real threat given the absence of new generation and the failure to put in new transmission assets that the state could face roving brownouts beginning as early as 2 years from now. It's a very serious concern. It's what motivated the Board of Public Utilities to approve the Susquehanna-Roseland transmission line that would allow for the importing of power from Pennsylvania to New Jersey. But that line up till now has been frustrated by the absence of certain federal approvals, not by FERC, but by the Parks Department, as a matter of fact, because there's an issue about the crossing of the Delaware River.
Well, Steve, I've got to cut you off there. We're going to wrap up here in just a second. How about you hit me with your contact information for people who want more information and to chat with you about this issue of importance in New Jersey and elsewhere?
Sure. I can be reached at Fox Rothschild in its Princeton office. My direct number is 609-896-4586, and the email is sgoldenberg@foxrothschild.com.
Very good. Well, we've been joined by Steve Goldenberg, who is the chair of the Fox Rothschild Energy and Public Utilities Practice Group, resident in their New Jersey office, talking about some of the challenges they face with new energy development. We're going to be back with more Capital Thinking right after this commercial break.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street, to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We're going to wrap things up today with an exciting First Amendment case. Joining us to talk about that is Jeff Pollack, also with the firm of Fox Rothschild. We just had somebody on from there last segment. Jeff is out of one of the New York offices. And Jeff, well, welcome to the show. We're going to be talking with you today about a very interesting First Amendment case, Neptune High School in Ocean Grove, New Jersey. They hold their annual graduation at a place called the Great Auditorium, which is owned by a Methodist church there, a great wooden structure that seats about 1,000 people and has been visited by lots of prominent historical figures over time. And apparently at this auditorium, there are some religious symbols. And Jeff, I want to have you kind of pick the story up from there and tell us a little bit about how that's evolved into a First Amendment case involving high school graduation.
Thanks for having me on. My wife, Saval Yildirim, who's a professor at Whittier, unfortunately is having phone difficulties, so I'm going to carry the ball on my own. Everything you said is right. And the core debate really is very simple. Whether a public high school, because Neptune High School is a public high school, can hold a graduation, as it has done for the last 70-some-odd years, at a facility which is owned by the Methodist Church. The critical thing here is that not only is there history here, but there's also two big signs, "So be ye holy and praise the Lord." And then there's the entire walkway to the building is illuminated by a approximately 40-foot electronic cross. In this case, there was an individual who went there as the grandparent of a graduate and said, that is not my religion, and I don't want to see those religious insignia. So they went to the ACLU, who came to me.
Interesting. And I guess the first question, you know, knowing from a first-year law perspective, civil procedure, is how's a grandmother get to be the person who has the standing to sue in this case? Seems to me like she's just along for the ride at a high school graduation.
I think years ago that might have been right. I think right now that's really not either the law. It's certainly not the law in New Jersey. You know, the Grandparents' Bill of Rights, even where a grandchild is adopted, New Jersey has said there is standing for grandparents to continue to visit the child. And so I think on this one, there was no doubt, and the school, by the way, didn't even bother running that argument because I think that was not their greater play. They really had their core argument, if they were to have one, was really that this is historical, and therefore it's kind of like in God we trust on the dollar that or on the dime that this is okay. And I think the reality is that the first test under the Establishment Clause is there a less intrusive, non-religious forum that you can use? And I pointed out to them that there were other forums, and because there, in fact, other high schools used them. They said this is historic, and I said, well, then we got a tough choice. I can either take a hard line and say no, Saval and I could have said no, you can't do it there at all, or alternatively, we tried to reach a middle ground, which was simply to cover the religious symbols for the one day of the graduation ceremony.
Very good. Well, I think we've been joined now by your co-counsel here, who's also your spouse, and that's Professor Saval Yildirim. I'm sorry if I've mangled your name there, Professor.
No, that's fine. Hello, everyone.
Glad that we could have you. So I guess, Professor, let me turn to you and ask a more basic question, which is, it's a high school graduation. What is wrong with having Christian religious symbols there or any religious symbols there?
Because we don't live in a religious society, and we live under a constitution, both federal and state, that promises every individual citizen the right to be free from religious symbols, especially those to which they do not believe in, in which they don't believe. So that is the problem with it. Imagine if we didn't have Christian symbols, but imagine if we had Buddhist symbols. Would we be having this discussion? I think it would be quite clear. We're only having this discussion because of majoritarian concerns, but democracy promises us freedom from majoritarian tyranny. So
well, let's talk about some of those constitutional rights. Tell us a little bit about the plaintiffs' assertions of their rights under the Constitution, both at the federal level and perhaps New Jersey has some more explicit, since we just talked about how grandparents have very specific rights in New Jersey. Perhaps they have also some additional First Amendment-like protections in the state Constitution.
There is, you're correct, that there is a distinction, although we think we would have prevailed under the federal Constitution and under the Constitution, under the First Amendment case law as enunciated by the United States Supreme Court. It also would have to be said that the United States Supreme Court has vacillated to some degree in this area because of the sensitivity of the balancing of the free exercise versus the Establishment Clause. So that there's two competing provisions right within the First Amendment. But all said and done, Saval and I believe that we would have prevailed under the First Amendment. But in this case, we articulated that under the New Jersey Constitution, it's crystal clear. Under Article 1, Section 3 of the New Jersey Constitution states that nor under any pretense whatsoever may an individual be compelled to any place of worship contrary to his faith and judgment. And it's absolutely clear from the case law that graduation day is a critical day in a undergrad's life.
Sure.
And there's a second provision that says there shall be no establishment of one religious sect in preference to another. So while the U.S. Constitution, we believe, does protect the course of action we took, it is absolutely unmitigatingly clear, which I think is why the school district here folded, if you will, that Article 1, Sections 3 and 4 absolutely protected the course of action we were taking.
Well, let me come back to you, Professor. Tell us what did happen. What is the ultimate disposition of this case?
Well, from our understanding, I mean, we did not go to the graduation, obviously, but from our understanding, the school district abided by the agreement, and they covered the symbols that we agreed should be covered. And so that's where we are.
And they actually, to follow up on Saval's point, they actually passed, the day before we were going to file suit, they passed a formal resolution accepting our proposition that they would have to cover those symbols now and into the future if they were going to continue to use that forum for graduation. And as we understand it, as Saval pointed out, that's what they did. But they did pass a formal resolution in order to avoid having to face a complaint.
I see. Well, let me sort of wrap things up there and ask maybe if you want to give out some contact information for you there at the firm, Jeff, for people who want to talk to you about First Amendment issues. I know you're a guy who has a great deal of complex litigation experience, not just in the First Amendment area, but for those who want to talk to you more about this case or other things, how can they get in touch with you?
If you go to the Fox Rothschild website, my last name is Pollock, P-O-L-L-O-C-K. And I can be reached either at the 100 Park, New York office or at the Princeton, New Jersey office.
Interesting. Well, it's always a very tangled set of circumstances, these cases that seem to involve high school graduation. And it's interesting to see how they work out legally and how especially the state constitutions now intertwine on some of these cases like yours. I think that's going to do it for this week's Capital Thinking. I hope everyone has a great 4th of July, celebrates the greatest land that the world has ever known, the greatest nation created in world history. Go out, celebrate with some fireworks, hot dog this weekend, maybe a jump in the pool or some golf and tennis. We'll join you next Thursday with more Capital Thinking right here on the Voice America Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.